This is the interview guest, Marilyn Johnson. She says that libraries are underappreciated in the digital age, and that young and hipper librarians are working hard to bring respect to a rapidly changing vocation. She isn't suing anyone, but she might after meeting the interviewer. This is the interviewer, Matt Segundo. He says that he's been wrongly arrested 68 times in the past 2 years, and that he's been targeted by an army of librarians who want to cut off his member. He claims that librarians have been making it difficult for him to drink his tequila. He's accused of trespassing, reading Danielle Steele, and general indecency. The participants are not actors. They are actual people talking around a New York table. Both parties have agreed to dismiss their obligations and have their disputes settled here in our forum, the Matt Segundo Show.
Okay, so I am here with Marilyn Johnson, who is most recently the author of This Book Is Overdue. Marilyn, how are you doing?
I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, I'm happy to have you here, although I did feel the overwhelming pressure of a librarian possibly confiscating the book while reading it. That or following in the vein of Abby Hoffman or whatnot. But let's start with a general question, and then we'll get into some more specifics later. I wanted to ask you, first and foremost, what central factors account for libraries being severely underestimated or underregarded by the general public?
I think a lot of educated people have wonderful memories of libraries that they used to go to when they were children. Mm-hmm. And the last time they set foot in a library was freshman year in college. And I think they have been using their computers and their IT departments and, you know, their own subscriptions to LexisNexis to get along just fine in the digital age. Yeah. And they don't understand that libraries have changed and that they are the fantastic engine of democracy right now. Yeah. They are the places where everybody can go, and ever so many people are going there. The numbers are up, the circulation is up. It's really a vital living part of our culture right now.
Sure.
And it's being cut, which is crazy.
You write in part about an issue that really troubles me, in fact, that I've written at length about, and that is the preservation of blogs,
yes,
websites on the internet. You note the New York Public Library's Josh Greenberg, his efforts to preserve digital archives, and there's also, of course, you bring up the Firefox extension Zotero. But can libraries, however, really either work with the people who host these websites or Google or whatnot? Is it something that that involves the library taking the central authority, or is it something that that really is going to require some kind of cooperation? You have many librarians in this book who have, in fact, adopted the realities of the digital age, but I wanted to talk about, first of all, this pressing problem of preserving all these wonderful online forms of expression and the like.
You know, it's unbelievable how much culture is being generated, how much commentary on our times, and how much creative expression is out there and disappearing all the time, being taken down by somebody who no longer is preserving it and maintaining the server, and people who are not preserving it. And on the other hand, you have these heroes like the man who's running the Internet Archive,
yes,
like some of the people at the Library of Congress, like some people from George Mason's Center for New Media, who are crawling around and trying to capture, crawling metaphorically around the Internet and trying to capture some of it in a usable form. I think it's a tremendous problem, and there are a lot of people addressing it, fortunately. We're very lucky to be living in times where people who might have been ordinary librarians in another age are figuring out how to get in there and preserve.
On the other hand, you have situations like, for example, I'm not sure if you heard the news, but today the original Rickroll video was removed from YouTube. Yes, so we have also this problem, too, of leaving our data to private entities like Google.
Yes.
And then you have the additional problem, like the Barnard Zine Archive, which you mentioned in this,
yes,
book. There had to be considerable efforts to get Barnard to advocate housing all these wonderful zines. And so on the issue of preservation of data, or even, like, I guess, the the pre-blogs, the zines, and the like. Who ultimately is responsible? Where does the onus fall? Would it be on these advocates that you're talking about, those who are so committed to preserving information, or
it's
do
on
we
all
have
of
to
us.
put the blame on private entities and the like?
It's on all of us. What gets saved, and I try to make this point very forcefully in the book, is what gets saved is what people save. And so it's the kind of thing where if you're interested in this issue, you say to yourself, I think I should save, oh, I don't know. Here's an example. There's a freelance librarian out there who said to himself way early on, he read a book of Hunter Thompson's and said, oh my goodness, this man is so interesting. He's going to be important in our age. I think I'll gather all of his early magazine work, his early writing. And he is now sitting on a cache of rare Hunter Thompson material that almost no one else has. And so I know a biographer of his, E. Jean Carroll, who connected with this guy, Kim Winship, and said, you have this? You have this cache of material? And she drove up, he's in upstate New York, drove up to see him and sat in his living room going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, somebody save this. You just figure out what it is you want to save, and surely you will figure out a way to save a corner of our culture.
Yeah, but isn't there a risk? We rely on Google here in the States, for example. Mm-hmm. The French, I'm sure you've been following this, have essentially said to Google Books, you know,
not for us.
Not for us. Mm-hmm. We will devote our government funds to preserving all of our culture. And this relates again to the issue of who really has the burden to preserve all this information. If we put it all in the private hands, on one hand, you have this guy who is preserving all of Hunter S. Thompson's archives, or a good chunk of them. On the other hand, you have the Rickroll scenario, which I mentioned earlier. So does the library, by way of being a public trust, have a greater advantage than, say, a private effort? Or do we need additional governmental authority along the lines of what the French have suggested?
It was tricky early on because of copyright issues.
Yeah.
And librarians are really not fond of breaking the law. So I think they held back a bit, and that situation has changed. And you see places like the Library of Congress and all their digital initiatives really trying to capture it and make it available to all of us. The way that we can make sure that it's safe is make copies of it. You know, I mean, you see things that go up on YouTube all the time, and they have been trying to police for copyright issues. So if there's music that is in the background of a very popular YouTube video, they will ask that music be replaced by something from their other files, and it changes the nature of the video that's up there.
Yeah.
It's all very tricky. So you go to, what's the other popular video site? Besides YouTube, Vimeo.
Plus you porn, but
no. Yeah, thanks. Vimeo,
yeah.
Is that it? Yes. So you can go to Vimeo and see the original one,
yeah.
For instance, of the Jessamyn West doing the, you know, installing the Ubuntu, which is fantastic, and which I describe, and which must have the Cajun music behind it to really be grokked.
Yeah. Until, of course, the person who created that Cajun music then goes after Vimeo.
You know, I bet they'd be behind it.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Well, I don't want to get entirely into a copyright discussion,
yeah,
although
that's
I could,
right.
But I do want to focus on libraries and the time we have. You bring up the interesting case of Joseph V. Hamburger. You know, he wrote a number of science fiction stories, all of which, or most of which, had not been published. And Joe and Sue Hamburger managed to save every scrap of paper and create a rather daunting archive, helped in part by their willingness to become devoted archivists. And because of this, Hamburger's papers are now in the Farmingdale collection at Rutgers. And so, as you point out in the book, so what I'm wondering is whether, again, going back to this issue of whether it takes someone who is a committed archivist, does the onus to preserve work like this fall upon the writer or the library? And then you get into a sort of Sophie's Choice scenario of what you preserve and what you don't preserve. Well, I'm curious
you know,
about what
are,
your thoughts.
Well, there are writers who leave instructions, who burn their letters,
yeah.
Who really do not want to be collected and saved. And then there are writers like Joseph V. Hamburger, who was largely unpublished. He had published many things, but not the things that meant the most to him, his creative science fiction work. And the Farmingdale collection, they had not accepted him. She had, his wife is an archivist, and quite a noteworthy archivist. She had approached them, and they, and there was silence on the line. They have not answered, and I don't know actually whether they have accepted these archives.
Really? I was led to believe by the book that they had accepted it.
Well, apparently. I hope that's not the impression that's left, because it's the saddest case. It's like he's still trying to publish his science fiction things. He's in the Farmingdale collection because he had been interviewed by a woman whose papers are there, because she had done all this study about Russian communists who were chicken farmers in New Jersey. And his parents were among the people who were the subjects of this documentary and the book that came with it. And so his wife thought this would be a natural place for his science fiction archives and the archives of his writing. And it would be a natural place, right? But maybe they don't have the space. I'm not really quite sure. Anyway, we're getting away from something that is an important question, which is, if a writer wants to be remembered, wouldn't it help a great deal if he or she took care to preserve the work that they did, the drafts that they went through, the letters and correspondence that they have, if they tried to preserve their emails? Yes, indeed, it would be wonderful and would help in the remembering of them and in the retracing and restructuring of, reconstructing of their lives. But libraries can play a tremendous role in this. And libraries where there are people who work at them with energy and vision and who really want to save, for instance, the work of the people who live in the that community, can take a leadership role in this. And there are easy things they can do. Zotero is this brilliant, easy application that you can add to Firefox. And I use it all the time. I'm collecting everything that gets written about this book. Easily organized, easily searched, no matter what happens, no matter who goes behind a paywall or what gets taken down, I have a copy. I can access that now.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing, you point out that to some degree the instructive onus falls upon writers, although knowing writers and knowing how scatterbrained they are, obviously you're either going to require librarians to nudge them in the right direction, or perhaps, you know, a spouse or a friend or some middleman to basically help the writer out to collect these valuable drafts. But I'm curious about what exists now to help the writer out, aside from this Firefox extension, which you mentioned. And I'm also curious about Salman Rushdie today. Mm-hmm. It was recently announced that he had decided to provide a digital version of his manuscript for his archive, where the user can go to a computer, play around with the phrasing, insert things, and then the minute that the user could log off, it would revert back to the original form. Now, is it going to require more intriguing
That's trippy.
Applications? Yeah, more. I know, it's really weird. More intriguing applications along those lines in order to make a case for a writer's work to be preserved. That's a lot to throw at you, so I'll just leave
but
it at that.
But how fascinating. It's just, these are really interesting times. Have you been on that website where people continue the Harry Potter story?
Yeah.
I mean, lots
of fanfic, too, yeah.
These are creative expressions also, and it's a phenomenon, just it seems to me, that anthropologists, cultural anthropologists would be interested in, or cultural historians. I'm certainly interested as a journalist in these kinds of things that bubble up. I mean, the cultures that develop around people, the line between the reader and the writer is getting really kind of, you know, mutable. I mean, it's like really very interesting to think that these collaborations between writers could involve readers. I love doing the history of the obit, the current history of the obit, because I thought that there were obit readers who were having as much impact on the structure and form of the obit as the writers were. And these readers, particularly those who were participating in this news group, Alt Obituaries, were being critics. They were talking back to the writers. They were making suggestions, and they were extending the obituary in the comments. Yeah. So they were, you know, adding new things about the writer, or they were making jokes about some aspect of it. Now you see in some of the British newspapers where there are people who were characters in the obit subject's life who write in afterwards, and their comments then get attached to the end of the digital record, and are published in, you know, the paper record, and become a valuable part of that experience. It's not just contained in those 800 words of the obit.
Yeah.
It's all this other stuff that gets added on to it.
Well, there's also the problem of the New York Times and the Washington Post are sitting on a rather hefty list of articles of obituaries waiting for some major figure to die.
I mean, it's the transformation.
It's come down to the point where you see dead obit writers
writing
obits. Like, I've seen Vincent Canby in the New York Times, like, a couple of years ago. He wrote an obit for some film person.
Blow your mind.
Does it really come down to mutability? Is part of the preservation process this idea of the text living longer than the writer's lifetime, and how does this factor into the archival process that libraries back to the beginning?
I don't know, but I was fascinated to see how the New York Times evolved in the way that they credited these obits. You know, it was sort of a joke, an inside joke, that a dead person had written a story about a dead person, and the dateline was yesterday.
Yeah.
That just didn't seem exactly right. So now what they do is they add a topper to those obits, so a living obit writer will announce the news of the death on top of the appreciation, which is given the byline of the person who is no longer with us, but in fact had done a very good job appreciating that person.
Yeah.
We have to invent the way that we deal with all of this stuff, you know, with the fact that the news cycle is not 15 minutes, the news cycle is continual. What do you preserve of those updates to the news?
Since we're on the topic of death, I will offer a rather morbid question. Now, you point quite frequently to the predicament of older people who are not entirely comfortable using technology, and librarians are there to help them use it. But Google and the internet remains fairly ubiquitous. We're going to see, perhaps in the next 40 or 50 years, a generation of users who are going to be absolutely familiar and possibly prefer the internet over libraries. So
they do already.
Yeah, they do. So at the risk
of... But not over libraries. Wait. I just have to stop you there because the internet is in the library, okay? Mm-hmm. Google is in the library. The librarians know how to use that. So you go to those public computers in the library. You have a librarian who can not only do Google, but who can also tell you, you know, point you to any number of other resources that are not included in Google, or that are very difficult to get to through Google. You know, it seems like Google is so simple. It's so simple even your grandmother could use it, is the way it was described to me. Yeah, it's brilliant for getting the quick hit on the restaurant in the village that you want to have dinner at. You know, there's the address, there's the phone number, there's a little Google map that will get you there. But when you are actually trying to track back, when I have a clipping of a newspaper and am trying to find the digital version of that, I get lost sometimes. It can't find it. The breadcrumbs don't take you to where you know it has to be. And I've had librarians who have actually shown me how to wend my way through Google, which is, after all, full of redundancies, not, you know, weighted in terms of date. You need to put your heavy boots on to wade through it sometimes.
Yeah.
But then again, we are seeing various developments along the lines of what we were mentioning earlier about the mutability of text, the semantic web, which I could probably
We could go on all night.
But to shift it to libraries, I mean, are the advantages essentially these informed people, the aspect of physical space, and the aspect of course, real life interaction as opposed to online interaction, do you think that these elements are strong enough to endure whenever technological developments are emerging in the next, like, four decades?
Okay, I'm zipping around the internet like crazy. I'm like, you know, I'm not unsavvy, okay? You know, I've, like, been a few corners. I've been to the few corners of the web. I make a telephone call, and if there are seven options, the automated answering service that tries to, you know, funnel me down one little hall as opposed to another, I never fit in the categories. I am never option 1 through 7. Yeah. Would you like to hear these options again? I freak out. I go crazy. I need the human. I need the human to help explain it to me. I need the human to help me know what I've missed. I needed the human to help me phrase the question. And I don't think humans are ever going to go out of style. Call me crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Until, of course, the inflatable human arrives.
No. You need the librarian.
Yeah, you need the librarian.
The recent New York Public Library consolidation caused the Shioki Noma Reading Room to be permanently closed on September 8th, 2008. You talked with John Lindquist, the former director of this Asian and Middle Eastern Reading Room, now curator, who pointed out that his staff had been halved. When the Arabic language cataloger retires, the library will be without an Arabic language librarian. So this closing is particularly ironic, given that in 1997, more than $1 million were poured into this room to refurbish it and to make it spruced up and the like. So if specialized knowledge like this is so fleeting, if something recently renovated only 10 years before is going to be thrown out the window, is it safe to say that generalists are winning this kind of internecine war within the libraries?
You know, they have a really interesting challenge, the New York Public Library, and they're galloping forward. They are really trying to take a research institution and preserve as much of the research in it as possible and also make it a much more tourist-friendly place. People don't understand when they come to the library that it is a research institution, that you don't check things out. So the New York Public Library, the board has decided, and the librarian, the chief librarians, that they'll have a children's center in the basement there, and they will circulate books there, and they want more regular users to come to this beautiful building. They want to open it up more. So all of those treasures from the Middle East are there. They're there. The librarians who administer them and who work with the scholars are not. They seem to be going away, and now John Lundquist has gone away. And this room went away, not because they didn't like the room or because they didn't like what it stood for, but because it happens to be on a central hall that's going to provide access to what will now be circulating parts of the library. They took this research library and are melding it with the circulating library. So in the course of making it friendly to people who want to just come and check out a DVD, they've had to squeeze some of the other stuff into different places. And those librarian positions that are very scholarly and very specialized, when they come up for retirement, they are not replacing those librarians.
Yeah.
They're putting into people who can work with the ordinary off the street library user.
Those librarians are part of this big squeeze. So therefore, will we have to turn more towards specialist libraries, such as the American Kennel Club Library, which you investigated, or will the onus fall upon universities to pick up the specialized slack?
Well, you want to hear a tragic story? I went to the American Kennel Club Library, and that librarian is no longer there.
Really?
And you know why? Because they're running out of money, and where are they going to cut it? You know, where are they going to cut funds? So the librarian is no longer working there. You can go there. There's an archivist. There are people who work for the American Kennel Club magazine. All the information is still there, all the material. The beautiful skeleton of the old dog looking over the reading tables is still there. But if you want to find something, you're going to be taking out a flashlight and looking around. It's just heartbreaking to me. These are really tough times. To lose the human being who is the guide to all this information and often the architect who put it all together it's craziness, and we are losing something so valuable right now. This book is overdue, and I wish it had come out last year before ever so many of these cuts had been instituted.
So it seems to me that the generalists are winning the war against the specialists, but you do bring up things such as the Second Life librarian. And the scenario there is that it's largely based up of volunteers.
Yes.
But if you're relying on volunteers and you're not relying upon compensation, then how can you have enough of a buffer to replace these vital specialists? Surely, and not only that, but if a librarian is essentially a persona, a metaphor, if you will, then does that necessarily replace the real thing? Is it something of a ruse, or more of a sort of fantasy than a duty to the public?
We're gonna go down some labyrinths here. You know what's interesting about Second Life is that there are bona fide librarians who are out there in their spare time doing research and development in the field. You know, like saying, here's a really interesting, wonky kind of thing that we can do. Let's see if we can adapt library science to it. And in fact, when you think about it, any population that you can think of could use a librarian to help it. You know, this is where the brilliant radical reference librarians who said, street protesters in great numbers coming to New York, a place that does not have public toilets, you know, let's go serve them some information. Let's go make ourselves available. And if they need us, they can ask us hard questions and we'll do our best to find true answers for them. You know, combat rumors, you know, help them navigate the streets, some of which will be closed. In Second Life, they're saying, oh my goodness, here's this exciting, cool, weird place, virtual reality on the internet. Anybody can access it by downloading the free software. And you create a little avatar and you go into this world. I bet they need librarians. And in fact, they do. You know why? Because ever so many little corners of this world are created by the people who go on Second Life as recreations of a time in history. For instance, there's a Renaissance island there that has a replica of Shakespeare's, what you call it, the theater.
The Globe, yeah.
The Globe. There is a Harlem Renaissance world there that recreates the 1920s. And so librarians are there doing all this research to help make that world accurate. They're saying, this is what fashion looked like. These are what cars look like. Yes, this was existed during that time. This didn't. This was how a joust went. This was what a lady would wear in her hair. And, you know, these kinds of factual historic questions are, librarians are ideally suited to answer them.
On the other hand, when you try to contact J.J. Drinkwater and these other folks, you had your Wi-Fi connection cut out on you. So this leads me to wonder if really you mentioned this in the book, that you were trying to interview the Second Life librarians, and then you were doing this in a library with your laptop.
Oh my goodness.
And there was a Wi-Fi cutout. So this leads me to wonder, the real thing is, you know, which is not going to cut out, I would hope someone would not dissolve before my eyes, is not exactly a best substitute for that.
Always. Well, I'll tell you, the story was that I didn't trust my Wi-Fi connection at home or my ability to not be interrupted when I went to do some of these interviews on Second Life. So I would go to my local library, to a quiet room, great Wi-Fi, you know, plenty of broadband, and I would do the interviews. And I forgot that the library itself was closing, the bricks and mortar library. And so I'm in the middle of this intense interview, and I come running out to my local librarians and say, is there any way I can stay? Is there a place in the parking lot that I can still get the signal? I'm interviewing a librarian here on this computer. And they just guffawed. They thought that was hilarious. Yeah. But they figured out a way for me to stay in the hall outside the library and keep the Wi-Fi connection going. Yeah. It's crazy. I can't access it without that Wi-Fi connection. It is and it's a fragile world. I mean, what if Second Life goes down?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
There are people trying to preserve the incredible work that they've been doing on Second Life, you know, so when we remember, oh yes, that incredibly fertile period between about 2006 and 2009.
Yeah.
When Second Life exploded, yeah, as you know, as a real creative place.
To jump back to the thread of the big question I had asked you before about specialists,
yeah,
and whether volunteer librarians can offer a suitable replacement for this dying paid specialist culture in libraries, is there anything in your investigations that would suggest that specialist librarians still thrive in some sense, or that volunteers can do the work of paid professionals?
No, volunteers cannot do the work of paid professionals. They are not a substitute. What is happening a lot, I notice, is in the democratization of the web, in the, you know, everybody hang up their own shingle and blog for free, you know, to be participating in the conversation, there are a lot of librarians out there. Some of them are out of work, yeah, some of them are underemployed, and, you know, some of them like having an identity out there. But they're fully trained. They have master's degrees in the structure of information. They understand ever so much. Is there a replacement for the specialist librarian who speaks Persian and can collect an irreplaceable, incredible, scholarly destination Persian?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think this is a very short-sighted, but it's very hard in this economic environment to make a case for those scholarly, academic, and very particular pursuits. It's hard for all of us. What makes me crazy is that librarians, regular public librarians, are out there putting people to work. Yeah. They are helping anybody who comes to their desk do the ultimate, put bread and butter in their own mouths. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that volunteers, maybe they could do it, I don't know, but here are librarians, not an expensive workforce.
Yeah.
They don't make a lot of money. Yeah. Cutting their jobs doesn't save a lot of money, and it puts a lot of us to work.
On the other hand, you had alluded to the street librarians earlier, and they say, hey, Twitter really saved our butts on this. Yeah. On the other hand, Twitter is not always the most reliable source. It's hearsay. It's what you heard. It's not something as concrete as a book. I mean, the whole scenario with Iran, all the media organizations were relying on Twitter, and some of that stuff ended up being not so precise. So the question is, if we are now living in a mutable culture and listening to strange people burrowing in walls, you know,
we could tell them to stop.
No, it's, okay. It's not going to be that bad. If we're living in a mutable culture and we don't have the absolute fact at our disposal, is this a problem? Is the librarian shifting by way of actually relying on mediums such as Twitter or inaccurate mediums of that sort?
Look, Twitter, I mean, you know, don't blame Twitter for this, and don't say the librarians were relying on something inaccurate. Twitter is a network. The librarians in 2004 were using the forerunner of Twitter, yeah, called TextMob.
Yeah.
But it was the same idea. They were talking to each other, okay? Mm. And so they were communicating. They could be spread out in quite different places and communicate with each other and say, the police have cordoned off 20th Street, don't send anybody down here. That's hard information when it comes from another librarian.
Yeah.
It's great, and it's better than the rumor or the reaction of a panic crowd when it starts to run this way or that.
Yeah.
Or if they're saying, you know, basically, don't come down to 20th Street, you know, bicycle accident, you know, if you run into a doctor, send him down here. I mean, that's invaluable. That's like an incredible network. Is it always true? Of course not. You know, people are not always true. But it's a fascinating tool. It's a terrific tool if you're on your feet and, you know, in a potential mob. And I think it's absolutely ingenious of these librarians to figure out how to serve a population that's not going to be coming through their door and that needs hard and reliable information.
Well, while we're on the subject of street librarians and radical reference, you note that they provide services regardless of political leaning, and street librarians were, of course, there for the 2008 National Republican Convention. But if radical reference maintains the banner answers for those who question authority, what has radical reference done for those who don't question authority? You write that radical reference has tried to serve activists across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Are they out there trying to service the needs of the Tea Party? Or do you have any indication of that?
No, I don't. And I don't really care. But if the Tea Party, if there's a Tea Party person listening who would like non-corporate answers. Yeah. I mean, answers, you know, people really digging for true answers. All he or she would have to do is post a question on the radref.info website. And, you know, I think it's radical reference spelled out .info, but easy enough to find. They are volunteer librarians, okay? They are librarians who are employed doing other things, academic libraries, public libraries, whatever, who volunteer their services part-time, who really think that it's important to be out there in the political atmosphere that we're currently in, helping to track down real answers.
One last question. I wanted to actually talk about the Patriot Act and the librarians who bravely opposed it. Now, If a librarian posts a sign along the lines of what you put in the book, the FBI has not been here, they may face a 5-year prison term. And I'm wondering, while those efforts to resist authoritarian law, as including, of course, the Connecticut Four, have been brave, have been very palpable, I'm wondering if these goals fall short somewhat because of the government's escalating authority and because the Patriot Act isn't going away, it's been renewed and the like, and whether librarians essentially have the duty to fight the good fight.
Well, you know, it's very tricky because librarians are law-abiding citizens. They really believe in the rule of law. This is, I should establish that to begin with. But they also, in their code of ethics, is the pledge that they will preserve the privacy of their patrons, and that's incredibly important to them. They really feel like the sanctity of the voting booth is the sanctity of asking the reference librarians questions. If you want help understanding a cancer diagnosis or help finding a job, you understand why that discretion is so important. So when these librarians saw the Patriot Act, Section 215, that there would be national security letters being issued by the FBI asking for information, they were worried that their library records were going to be ransacked. And they think this is in clear violation of our constitutional rights. And so there was a calculated decision on the part of these three librarians and their consortium's director to mount a challenge to it. And they went off on their own. They were rogue librarians doing this. You have to understand this.
Rogue in the best sense of the word.
Well, to me, they're my heroes, and I say this really quite clearly. And they underwent the most, I mean, it's really an incredible, their story is incredible. It's like 1984, Alice down the rabbit hole. They're taking down the walls around us.
Yeah,
they're coming to get us. At any rate, their whole story makes a chapter that I worked very hard on to talk about how really ordinary citizens, I mean, these people, you would not be able to pick them out of a crowd. When they had something that they believed in, when they felt that they were standing up for their patrons and their rights, they were willing to go to the wall. They were willing to be jailed. They were willing to be bankrupt. They were under a gag order and could not even tell their spouses that they had sued the Attorney General of the United States to lift this gag order. It's really interesting times.
I do agree with you that it's principled stand, but must it be a continuing stand against this if
those sacred core values of privacy are to be upheld.
Yes, it is a continual battle, and it's continually being thrashed out. You know, to do the difference between community standards and pure free speech, you don't go into public libraries and find pornography on the shelves.
Yeah.
That's, well, my goodness, why not?
Yeah.
Some would say, but others would say, well, of course we're not going to have pornography on the shelves. You know, it's like we're always sort of navigating the gray middle. And I think librarians are asking themselves the fresh questions every day, and really going out there and defending us, helping us, trying to be useful to us. And I'm so happy to have known so many of them and actually persuaded them to participate in this book.
Well, on that optimistic note, Marilyn, thanks very much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure to
chat. Oh, it was so nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay.